Back together again, you and I, to wrap up a very busy week on Friday, May 20th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. I talked about another close call involving juvenile suspects at a nearby mall. Local gasoline analyst Mike Fox joined us again to talk about, yes, just how high gas prices at the pump may eventually go with the July 4th weekend coming up in just a few weeks. Immigration attorney Renata Castro chatted with us about the current controversy surrounding immigration as we waited for a decision on Title 42 at the U.S. southern border. And how about this? You know, folks, I honestly hate to read stories like this, but I have to, because I feel a responsibility here to let you people know when stuff like this happens, to be aware of your surroundings. Every police person that's on this show, that's on with Lisa in the middays, I'm sure Norm Pattis would say this if you asked him. Norm, now Monday through Friday, noon to 2 here on WICC. And what does Lieutenant Perez say on Crime of the Mind every Monday with Melissa? Be aware of your surroundings. How about this story that broke yesterday afternoon? Police in Trumbull have charged three teens in carjacking a woman at the Trumbull Mall. Folks, I'm telling you, if you go to malls, seriously, be careful. Look around. You know why? Parking lots are big, right? Parking lots are big. A lot of times these gangs of teens, these miscreants, these young criminals in training out there, they hide behind cars, or they're sitting in a car with blacked out windows and they say, okay, let's get her. No. Be careful of where you are. Park as close to the mall entrance as you can, especially you women. So if you're going to the Milford Mall on the Post Road, you're going to Trumbull, you're going to Meriden, you're going to West Farms, I'm sorry. I mean, I don't mean to indict these malls for lack of safety. That's not what I'm doing here at all. I'm just telling you to watch the heck out, because this is happening in broad daylight. Police arresting three teenagers. That's right. The future great minds of America. Maybe they were just a little late for their Mensa meeting, so they figured they might as well, you know, carjack somebody. Police arresting three teenagers after they allegedly robbed a woman and stole her car Thursday afternoon yesterday at the Westfield Trumbull Mall. This story, courtesy of the Connecticut Post, Hearst, Connecticut Media, Liz Hardaway's story. A 59-year-old Trumbull woman was loading her car in the mall parking lot around 2:45 p.m. So we were on the air when this happened, when three teenage boys demanded her car keys. At least one of the teens pushed her from behind, took her purse from her hands along with her keys. That's according to Trumbull police. Carry a gun, ladies, I'm telling you. You may want to consider it. Now, if you pull it out, you got to use it. But this is why more and more, ask any gun dealer and gun training person, a shooting range person, how many women are carrying guns now? The teens then sped off toward Main Street in her car. The woman described the suspects and her car to police, who provided the info to surrounding police departments. Police spotted the car a short time later in Danbury. See, a lot of times these gangs of roving thugs, miscreants, future convicts of America, they come from out of town. And they figure they escape on 95, 91, the Parkway, Route 25, Route 7. The car sped off when officers approached it, police said. Son of a gun, you're kidding me, really? You're kidding me, really? Honest to God. Officers in the area continued to search, and police in Monroe find. So we were in Danbury, now we're back to Monroe. It's kind of a travel log, you know, when these young criminals say, hey, let's jack a car and take it for a ride because the popo's coming. Police follow the car through heavy traffic back to Trumbull. So we went Trumbull to Danbury to Monroe, and then we went back to Trumbull, where officers were waiting at the intersection of Monroe Turnpike or Route 111. The suspects attempted to escape and sped across the road, going south in the neighboring lane of the highway for a bit. The driver, a 16-year-old boy. Bet your mom and dad are proud. They going to talk about this at his graduation? The driver, a 16-year-old boy, lost control of the car. It careened off a road and struck a signpost. The three teenagers attempted to run away. What a shock. But officers with the Trumbull and Monroe Police Departments, as well as the Bridgeport Auto Theft Task Force, quickly apprehended them. So good work there. All three suspects. Now get this. You ready for this? All three suspects. One of them a 15-year-old boy. And two of them 16-year-old boys. All charged with first-degree larceny, third-degree robbery, robbery by carjacking, breach of peace, and interfering with an officer. A 15-year-old and two 16-year-olds. You know, it's almost weird now not to see, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say miscreants, alleged miscreants, not doing this like in their late teens or early 20s. Now it's kind of like par for the course, isn't it? Oh, yeah, 15, 16-year-olds. Can you imagine this? Think about when, well, I can remember when I was 15 or 16. Can you imagine when you were 15 or 16 doing this? Of course most of you can't. You wouldn't think of this. You'd be terrified of the cops. You actually grew up with some morals. Saying, no, you don't go near a gun. You don't go near somebody else's car or SUV. One 15-year-old, two 16-year-olds, all boys, charged with first-degree larceny, third-degree robbery, robbery by carjacking, breach of peace, and interfering with an officer. All right? Got that? The driver was also charged with reckless driving and operating a motor vehicle without a license. That's according to police. Now, you ready for this? This is your cherry on top. If this story was like a Dairy Queen sundae and you... When you know when you're putting the sprinkles and the whipped cream on there, it all looks good, and on top goes that maraschino cherry, baby. Yeah, you ready for this? Police say the juveniles were later released to the custody of their guardians. Released to the custody of their guardians on a promise to appear in Bridgeport Juvenile Court. Now, think about what transpired here. A woman was attacked, physically assaulted in the middle of the day. Three teens got her car, got in the car, stole the car, went off on a crazy high-speed chase involving multiple police departments. The car crashed at assumingly a high speed. Thank God nobody was killed or injured. And then, you know, the cops took them in. They give them all these charges. And under Connecticut law, now, again, it doesn't say here. And again, I am reading a story here in the Connecticut Post, Hearst Connecticut Media, Liz Hardaway story. I want to give credit where credit is due. Again, now, we don't know whether this is a first offense for any of these three juveniles, two 16-year-old boys, one 15-year-old, or these multiple offenses, I don't know. But this is the point, folks, I make when I read stories about this. This is the point. I don't care whether it's a first offense. It may be a third or fourth. I don't care whether it's a first offense. How on God's green earth, honestly, and if you can explain this to me, please, I'd love to hear you chat about this. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Physically assaulting a 59-year-old woman in broad daylight, stealing her vehicle, running the vehicle up to Danbury, to Monroe, back to Trumbull, from Trumbull, endangering citizens, endangering police officers, endangering other pedestrians, multiple charges. How the hell are these three allowed to go home with their guardians? How is that possible? And don't give me this business. I want to throw him in jail right away and throw away the key. I'm not saying that. But what kind of a message does that send? Again, you're not talking about a 15-year-old and two 16-year-olds who broke a few windows or maybe smashed a car window and took a camera out of a car or a laptop or something. All right, it's a property crime. With the description that I just read you right here on a Friday afternoon of a crime that broke in broad daylight, a 15-year-old and two 16-year-olds charged with first-degree larceny, third-degree robbery, robbery by carjacking, breach of peace, and interfering with an officer and the pièce de résistance. They were later released to the custody of their guardians. Are you kidding me? Are you freaking kidding me? I'm definitely no police officer, no law enforcement officer, no expert in the penal code or expert in incarceration. But doesn't it stand to reason that at the end of all this, when this situation is still fresh in the minds of people, for the love of God, doesn't it stand reason that those three should be taken and put somewhere for at least a day or two to cool off, where social workers, prison workers, youth experts can sit them down and say, you're in big trouble. And I'm sure the judge must have done this or whatever the arraignment. But the bottom line is they were released back to their guardians. How? You tell me. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. How does this make any sense? With the severity of that crime, how does that make any sense? Again, I'm quoting here. Police say the juveniles were later released to the custody of their guardians on a promise to appear in court. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? After all that happened during those frantic few minutes, thank God nobody was seriously hurt or injured. And you wonder why people are angry. You wonder why people buy guns. Well, yeah, we like to give it to you straight, and this one might be a little painful because it is straight. The national average gasoline, a gallon of regular unleaded today at the pump, national average $4.59 a gallon. The average, as you and I speak right now at this very second in Connecticut, according to our friends at the AAA, $4.68 a gallon. How high is this going to go? That's kind of the question we always ask our next guest. And Mike Fox joins us from GASDA, the Fairfield County-based gasoline and automobile services dealers of America. Mike, it's Paul here again at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Thank you for having me again.
Well, Mike, you know, I look, don't take this the wrong way, Mike, but I look at you, you know, we have to have you on every few months because, you know, it's good preventative maintenance. It's kind of like, you know, getting your teeth clean, going to the dentist, because you got to do it. And people need to know, Mike, where the money is going here. So you tell us, Mike, you're looking at the X-ray of the gasoline industry right now. What do you see?
Well, unfortunately, the policies out of Washington have not changed. They've actually gotten worse. And the repair job or fix for high retail gas prices is now to go to Iran, Venezuela, and Saudi Arabia, foreign countries with the exception of Saudi Arabia that are not necessarily friendly to the United States, and ask them to produce more crude oil to be shipped to the United States. My first comment is Venezuela is the dirtiest crude oil in the world. So we're going to bring in a crude oil. But remember, the Biden administration believes in climate change and green energy. So instead of bringing in clean crude that we have here in the United States, we're going to bring in dirty crude from Venezuela. And it's not going to cost more to bring it from Venezuela, say, to that refinery in Texas on a ship that uses diesel fuel that's now over $6 a gallon. So, again, when you want to look at what the problem is, no matter what people in Washington are saying, here's the facts. January 2020, President Trump was in office. The wholesale price, and I'll use wholesale prices because it's important. The cheaper the wholesale price, the cheaper the retail price. In January 2020, under President Trump, wholesale prices averaged about $1.75 a gallon. When President Biden was inaugurated in office in January of 2021, wholesale prices continued to decline for a year to down to $1.62. On January 27th, 2021, President Biden signs an executive order banning drilling in the U.S. and suspends the Keystone Pipeline. Automatically, January, at the end of January of 2022, a year later, wholesale prices rocketed to $2.50, up 55% or 88 cents a gallon. Now, remember, he blamed Putin and Ukraine. Well, it didn't happen for another month, and then Putin attacked Ukraine, and the next month, gas prices went from $2.50 to $2.70, or an 8% increase, or 20 cents a gallon. Now we rocket forward a year later, and we see that we've gone from $2.50 when the president took office to $3.87 wholesale, or up 55% in 3 months. So since President Biden has taken office, wholesale gas prices in Connecticut have gone from $1.62 to $3.87, or an increase of 140%. And he wants you and your listeners to believe this has nothing to do with the policies that he put in effect. I think the facts say something completely different.
And Mike, before we take a break, so you're not buying, obviously, this is all with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. What about the role, Mike, of, listen, speculators, legal commodities traders? How much is that a problem here or not, or somewhat?
So I agree with that comment about speculators. And here's what speculators work on. They work on policy. Did we not have speculators the 4 years of Donald Trump? And those speculators recognize that the policies of the Trump administration were to drill, baby, drill, make U.S. crude oil production to be the highest levels of production anywhere in the world. So speculators recognize that's a recipe for downward prices, not increased prices. Fast forward to 2022. What is the policy in Washington today? We're going to completely eliminate fossil fuels in the United States. We're going to ban pipelines to deliver crude oil cost effectively and efficiently. And we're going to bring in dirty crude from Venezuela and Iran, countries that are not favorable to the United States. You're right. The speculator says this is a market for high prices. There's nothing illegal about it. It is the business world. When you know there's going to be a shortage of something, you simply have the ability to charge more. And I've always argued that. It always perplexed me prior to the Trump administration, and we had Republican administrations before Donald Trump. Why did the price of gas always go up for Memorial Day and Labor Day and 4th of July? Simply because there was increased demand. Not because we couldn't produce enough. There was a higher demand. You could therefore charge more prices. And that's the way the world works. President Biden has been in office as a politician for over 40 years. He gets that. So he is instituting policies that are the exact opposite to make America strong, which was the MAGA policy, make America great again. Manufacture here in the United States, produce here in the United States, be independent from the rest of the world, sell to the rest of the world where we can charge more in those other parts of the world so it costs us less here in the United States. Now go to Venezuela and Iran.
Okay, Mike, hang on. Yeah, hang on, Mike. I want to pick up on that when we come back. I want to get into more of the Venezuela-Iran thing. And also, what do you see the next few weeks? Mike, hang on. Mike Fox is with us from Gazda. More on gas prices. What's this going to look like? I'll ask Mike when we come back. What's this going to look like around the July 4th holiday weekend? More with Mike coming up at WICC. Yeah, we continue to talk gas prices with Mike Fox from Gazda. Check him out online, GASDA.org. And if you're buying regular gas today, of course, unleaded in the state, it's at a record again, $4.68 a gallon. Diesel today down slightly from yesterday, but still, if you're putting diesel in your construction vehicles or your pickup truck, perhaps $6.40 a gallon. Mike, you wanted to continue here with something about Venezuela and other countries, so go ahead with that. And I also want to ask you what you foresee in a few weeks on a day that you've always talked about, or a weekend you've talked about, heading into July 4th. What did you want to say first about those other countries?
So that's what's going to make 4th of July even more disgusting to your viewers. So when you look at the retail price for gasoline in Venezuela, it's 20 cents a gallon. When you look at the retail price for gasoline in Iran, it's 8 cents a gallon. And that's, so we're going to bring those products into the United States. We're going to have to adapt to U.S. environmental regulations. And by 4th of July, and because of the current policies in Washington, D.C., I predict we're going to be paying between $6.25 and $6.50 a gallon for regular unleaded on 4th of July weekend.
So you're confident, Mike Fox, that we'll be over $6 a gallon, really?
I see nothing except tightening of the policies that make no sense. Recently, we heard two things out of Washington to address high prices. We're preventing drilling and no more leases in Anwar, one of the most productive reserves in the world for crude oil. Banned. Now we're asking Venezuela to send us crude oil, which is the dirtiest crude oil in the world, is going to cost almost 2.5 times to refine into clean fuel as required by US EPA, which is a good thing. Why are any of those two policies going to drive prices down? I look at what goes on in the real world, the real facts. I see nothing. If you remember, Paul, and I think if you go back to one of your shows that we did in early February, a couple days after my birthday, I said to you then, we will see $6 to $7 gasoline in Connecticut. I didn't think it would come this soon. I believe then I said by the end of the year. Now I'm predicting $6 to $6.50 by 4th of July.
Mike, what about final question for you? What do you make some politicos in Washington now accusing the big oil companies of profiteering here? They are price gouging. People say they could sell that gasoline for less. They should take fewer profits, don't worry about their shareholders for a while, and give the people of the U.S. a break. What do you think about that?
Well, Paul, you've known me for a long time, and the last thing I want to do is stick up for big oil. So during the pandemic and COVID, ExxonMobil, let's just take them as an example because they're the biggest, they lost $5 billion. Where was the sympathy for them then? The next year coming out of the pandemic, they made $6 billion. Add the 2 years together, it comes to a $1 billion profit over 2 years. I don't think that's a big profit for companies that invest billions and billions just to drill and see if we even have oil. So we can always blame somebody. It just doesn't make any sense. Jeff Bezos, people like that with Amazon, they make billions and billions of dollars. They earn it. If we don't like what we see on Amazon, we go somewhere else and buy it. The problem is, where do you go to get your gas? It's the only game in town.
That's right. Mike Fox, Gazda. Check out the website, Gazda.org, G-A-S-D-A, Gazda.org. Mike, be good. We'll talk to you a few weeks down the road. Thank you, sir, as always.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. There you go. Well, listen, love Mike, but I don't know. Let's hope his prediction doesn't come true. He is sticking by an earlier prediction that he made a few weeks back. January, February, 6.25 minimum he sees gas in the state. I'm telling you, there's going to have to be national days announced by, I don't know, maybe the White House will do this. I don't know. There's going to have to be days, maybe a weekend, maybe some days during the week where people just don't drive. Stay home, work from home, drive down the demand and make the supply hardly move. And maybe you drive down the cost there. Who knows? Who knows? Anna, we have talked a lot about immigration on this show for the past couple of years, talked about all angles of it, I think. But I'm happy to finally have an immigration attorney on the show to talk about this, Title 42, what goes on at the border, what should be done, some ideas coming from Renata Castro, the founding member of the Castro Legal Group, a full-service immigration firm. She represents a wide range of clients, from accomplished athletes and extraordinary individuals to investors, victims of domestic violence, as well as many others seeking a new life in the U.S. Renata, hi, it's Paul here at WICC in Connecticut. Good afternoon. How are you?
Thanks for having me, especially now at a time where the immigration conversation is so relevant for your listeners in Connecticut.
Yeah, tell me, first of all, Renata, every time this pops up, people hear the term immigration law, and they kind of know what it is. Oh, yeah, a friend of mine immigrated here, or my cousins did, or my parents years ago. But if you could just give us a brief summation of obviously we know from the title what it is, but how difficult of a practice of law is that? What is an immigration lawyer faced with, like yourself, every day?
Well, an immigration lawyer never knows how his day is going to end. So that just gives you an idea and your listeners the kind of dynamic we have as an immigration practitioner. The practice of immigration law has really been one always directly affected by the changes in the White House, because being an administrative area of or an area of law applied by administrative agencies, there's a lot of discretion, and that can make for very, very fluctuating terrain when it comes to the practice and the application of immigration on immigration petitions. I must say that the current administration is trying to create a more streamlined process for immigrants, but as the years have passed, it has become increasingly more difficult and more expensive for individuals to come or remain in the United States, no matter the benefit that they may bring to this country.
You know, Renata, I want to touch on one thing you just mentioned, and please, I'm not asking you about your fees or any other person's fees, but I have talked to people who have said, you know, they've had to save up, the ones who come here legally, and we'll talk about the other issues in a moment, but, you know, somebody who gets a sponsor and wants to come here legally, I mean, I have heard areas of $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, you know, these people saving up for years. Would you say that's pretty accurate as to what it costs and people may not realize?
Yes, I think that a lot of individuals who have not gone through the immigration process are unaware of how expensive and how challenging it is for those looking to come to the United States legally to seek proper representation and to obtain the desired outcome. For example, a family of four individuals going through, let's say, an extraordinary ability application would easily spend anywhere between $8,000 to $10,000 only in filing fees and medical exams.
Wow.
So it is a major financial and emotional commitment for those who are looking to start their lives in the United States. You are right about the figures.
Immigration attorney Renata Castro is the guest. Renata, stand by. We'll be right back with you. We'll ask her about the deal at the border, what she thinks. What would she do if she was running Homeland Security and Border Protection? More with Renata Castro coming up first. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. The website is CastroLegalGroup.com. Check out the website, CastroLegalGroup.com. Immigration attorney Renata Castro is the guest. Renata, we all can wrap our arms around legal immigration, as you mentioned, the process that is structured. It does take a while. It is costly. Talk to my listeners here and explain a little bit of what happens for undocumented migrants at the border who cross and then claim asylum. Explain the asylum process here, how that works. And I know some of these cases can drag on for years, but how does that work?
I think it's important to establish that individuals who come to the border and seek asylum protection are not violating U.S. law. In fact, that they are acting on a possibility given to any individual by, you know, codified U.S. immigration law. The law is outdated, ineffective, because it puts individuals at risk for their lives as they come to the border, present themselves seeking asylum protection, are allowed into the United States, and sometimes their cases take 10, 12 years to be heard. And only then, after they have rebuilt their lives, built businesses, bought homes, they are told they cannot stay in the United States. So the asylum protection is only afforded. It's very hard to receive an asylum grant in the United States because it is only afforded to those who have a credible fear as a result of persecution based on their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or because they belong to a particular social group. There are no free attorneys, and a lot of individuals go through a very expensive and lengthy process trying to win their asylum cases, only to be told after a long period of time that they now have to leave the United States.
So in an ideal world, Renata, if you were head of Border Protection or Immigration, how could we streamline this process? Because I think it would be better for all of us. It's a multi-tiered thing here. We can talk about how many people want to come across, but once they're here, that horse is out of the barn. Now we have to have a process here. Can that be streamlined or made better if we just hired more people, expanded the courts, expanded investigators or investigations? What would be the best way to do this, and how long would that take?
If I was to present the administration or any administration with a way to streamline asylum applications, is to allow embassies and consulates of the United States abroad to process applications for asylum. They have boots on the ground, and they are able to ascertain local conditions a lot better than some immigration judges in the United States that have never been exposed to the conditions of that area, because asylum law is very very much impacted by the locale or the country of citizenship of an individual seeking that protection. It would be more humane. It would be more effective to the United States. It would allow us to get people here who have a real fear for their lives and who would be allowed to stay and contribute to the economy and well-being and the growth of the United States.
And, you know, Renata, because I think the extremes on both end of the political spectrum have been sometimes intransigent here for political or business purposes, one side or the other, it does make the ground fertile, does it not, for these coyotes, these human traffickers, these people who will, you know, extort life savings from people when they say, well, don't worry, I'll get you over the border. From what I read, it just makes for a dangerous situation, doesn't it?
Very dangerous. My office represents dozens of individuals who have been who have become victims of human trafficking, as they were promised very much their version of the American dream, only to find themselves kidnapped, extorted, raped, and in really dismal conditions as they see their American dream become a nightmare. Once the government, both sides of the aisle, realize that right immigration is good, is not good, is great for the United States, and we ought to do it for the benefit of our country, not only for the benefit of immigrants. It is to make sure that the United States remains competitive and remains a vibrant, thriving economy in the world. Immigration is an essential part of that, and we need to have a reasonable law-based conversation as opposed to just using it as a recourse to get votes at the next election.
It does really seem, Renata, that no matter who is in, as you say, no matter what party occupies the White House or who controls Congress, you know, Renata, immigration along with some election issues and Social Security, these are these hot rails, these third rails that nobody really wants to touch with any great conviction.
I am always surprised, and I was involved in politics. I ran for office twice at a local level, and I was always surprised at the little knowledge members of, you know, different cabinets at a federal level lacked about immigration law. So I think that there has to be more education to both sides of the aisle. Step away from rhetoric. Understand how the United States can and should be using legislative immigration reform. And by reform, I'm not saying amnesty. It is to make sure that we're applying our resources to the benefit of the United States. And it is not in the benefit of this country to shut down its doors completely, not only to qualified talent. The United States is struggling with blue-collar labor.
Yeah.
That's a major issue that we have. So what we don't see is American employers being punished by hiring undocumented aliens, curtailing wages, and really not benefiting our economy. We need immigrants in a systematized, checks and balances way, and it's about time that the American people ask their representatives to do it for the country, not because you're an immigrant or because you're impacted by immigration on a personal level, but because legal immigration is the right solution for our economy and for our country, our security.
It must be pretty frustrating that, as you said, members of Congress don't understand immigration law that Congress themselves wrote, right?
Well, I guess that's politics. They don't, at times they don't understand what they wrote, because it's always the pursuit of votes when it should be the pursuit of the well-being of the American people. And knowing who we bring to the United States, how we bring them, and making it effective so that we're not spending billions of dollars in immigration enforcement and really immigration detention, which only puts money in the pockets of the private immigration detention center operators, should be a priority at this election more than any time in our history.
Castro Legal Group is the website. Renata Castro, immigration attorney, has been the guest. Renata, thank you. We appreciate it. Take care, and hopefully we can chat again down the road. Thank you.
That would be great, and I hope you and your listeners have a great weekend.
Thank you. Renata Castro there, R-E-N-A-T-A, Castro, C-A-S-T-R-O.